This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. President Joe Biden last week announced a plan to forgive a portion of federal college loan debt for millions of Americans. In a speech from the White House, he explained that the Department of Education would, quote, forgive $10,000 in outstanding federal student loans, and that Pell Grant recipients would have their debt reduced by $20,000. Only those making less than $125,000 a year would qualify for the relief. Given that the average student debt is nearly $30,000, this certainly does not erase the burden that so many Americans carry with them. Biden's plan is expected to erase only a tiny sliver of the $1.75 trillion that is owed nationwide on student loans. How did higher education become so expensive in the first place that so many Americans are burdened by student debt? Joining me to help answer that question is Devin Fergus, the Arva E. Strickland Distinguished Professor of History and Black Studies at the University of Missouri. His books include Land of the Free, Hidden Costs, and the Decline of the American Middle Class. In 2014, he wrote a Washington Post op-ed called My Students Pay Too Much for College, Blame Reagan. Welcome to the program, Devin.
Thank you so much, Sonali, for having me.
So just to give our audience some background, especially for those who might just be entering college, it wasn't always the case that college was so expensive in the United States, right? In fact, just a few decades ago, it was relatively affordable, and often it was almost free, right?
Oh, absolutely right. In the late 70s, early 80s, basically only a third of students borrowed for college. But by 2000, 2001, two-thirds of students borrowed for college, and the vast majority of students now borrow for college. Today, just to get through. But it wasn't always this way. You're absolutely right, Sonali.
And so there was a time when you could go to college. If it cost anything, you could work a job on the side, pay the small amount that it cost. If you wanted to go to a very expensive private college, you might take out a large-ish loan. These days, even sometimes for attending state universities, you have people going into debt. They might be working. They might still not be able to make enough to pay it off, and so they take out loans. So first, let's talk about what Reagan did. He was, of course, the one who famously said that the only good government is small government, or something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing here. What was it about Reagan's overall grand plan to slash federal spending that impacted higher education?
Sure. So in what I talk about both in my book, Land of the Free, and the op-ed piece that you referenced, was the change in mentality and mindset that came under Reagan. Prior to the Reagan administration, there was a basic fundamental belief that students were future tax contributors. And so the state or government would invest in students, because that would be in effect an investing in the future of the country. So rather than so view students basically as future tax contributors, what Reagan administration, what Reagan and his acolytes who came into government did was basically change that sort of mindset. And rather than viewing students as future tax contributors, they thought of students as tax eaters. In this sense, they really lumped students in with what they considered the undeserving population in America. Your father on unemployment insurance, your mother on welfare, grandma on Medicaid. And for this generation of really conservatives, they view students as, like those populations, as tax eaters like the quote-unquote welfare queen, or the out-of-work father who doesn't want to work and is drawing unemployment insurance. And so they view students as these as one of these tax eaters, like they view the other undeserving population.
And it was in about a decade or so before Reagan's approach to college funding that the Powell memo came out, right? It was 1971 that Lewis Powell, Justice Lewis Powell, wrote the secret memo that became public, where higher education and the fact that it was so accessible was seen as a threat to the country, because he saw it actually as a threat to capitalism, right?
Yeah, no, precisely. I'm putting on my academic hat at some level. It would be wonderful to have scholars really working on really this subject area. It's quite ironic that the same moment that higher education becomes more democratized, people who previously had not access to higher education now have access to it. That same moment, what we see is that barriers of entry get created, not necessarily in the admissions process, but in the financial process. So how do we keep these populations out in many ways? So we increase ratchet up the cost of it, and that will create a barrier of entry. And it happens in areas of student loan industry. We see it happening in other areas and spheres of American life. Home ownership is a classic example. Barriers of entry gets erected. Even areas of auto insurance, barriers of entry get erected. One of the most pernicious ones is in the area of student aid and financial aid. Not only most pernicious, but also most consequential. We've just gone through, if you the last decade, the Great Recession and the financial cost that the rise of home ownership and subprime mortgages had on folks, and that's critically important. But before one buys or purchases a home, the first major financial transaction one usually engages in is in the taking out of a student loan. As you mentioned before, Sonali, quite eloquently, that the average borrower today, again, this is the average, the median borrower today has about almost $30,000 in student loans. And so this is the first major transaction that we as financial citizens encounter. And it has a cascading effect that impacts one's ability to buy a home and other sort of financial costs, to borrow money for a car, to get us to work once we have a job. And so this is the first major financial transaction one encounters, and it's quite consequential. As I said before, it has a cascading effect along the life of the borrower.
I want to quote from the piece you wrote in the Washington Post about Reagan and specifically what he did. Spending on higher education was slashed by some 25% between 1980 and 85. In raw dollar figures, cuts totaled $594 million in student assistance and $338 million in Pell grants. Now, around the same time, or maybe after, wasn't it also true then that state funding also became less and less and was being slashed, state funding for state universities?
No, you're absolutely right. And a parallel experience that has happened at the state level. But I think the federal level sort of begins a little earlier. And if you dig into the archives, too, what you see is state legislatures petitioning, and state legislatures, college presidents petitioning the executive branch in particular to help to not cut the costs. So yes, this is occurring at the state level, and my really good friends at DEMOS have done some excellent research on this a few years ago. Look at the rising costs at the state level. But prior to actually taking off the state level, it really happens first at the federal level, and you see state legislatures kind of petitioning, appealing to the federal government on the impact it's going to have, and petitioning, asking them to not cut these costs, but they ended up doing it anyway.
So basically, federal and state subsidies for higher education were slashed in the 80s. This didn't actually result in necessarily fewer people going to college, because we live in a country that claims to be a meritocracy. And so people have naturally felt that in order to make ends meet, one needs a university education. And we've seen enrollment rise among women, among people of color. And of course, today in our an economy that's so precarious, you end up having a lot of folks graduating with college debt. and not necessarily that many prospects. Let's specifically talk about the racial wealth gap, Devin, and how the Reagan attack on higher education, states defunding of higher education, has fueled the racial wealth gap.
Sure, absolutely. And so the research record shows that not simply are people, African Americans in particular, more likely to borrow than the average population, but they're also more likely to borrow more. And it makes sense. That people going into college, if you often have resources from their family, whether this is out of home equity or personal savings, people of color, particularly African Americans, have fewer of those resources, whether it's home equity or personal savings, and thus they must rely on borrowing on the state or funding to finance college. So again, they have fewer personal resources. Thus, they're more likely to borrow than the general population, and they're more likely to borrow more.
There's just less generational wealth, and that goes all the way back to the origins of this nation and the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow, mm-hmm. segregation, et cetera, institutionalized racism.
No, precisely, absolutely right. And so what ends up happening, you come out of college as a person of color, and African Americans, but also Latinos too, often are borrowing. Asian American population is a very sort of variegated one and diverse one, and so some particularly more recent immigrants coming in may have fewer resources. And so what ends up happening is that you come out of college as a person of color, particularly as African American, borrowing more, which means that you actually have a higher debt to income ratio. And that higher debt to income ratio means that if you want to go buy a house or buy a home, you're either going to pay more for that interest rate because you have a debt to income ratio, or you may postpone home ownership. And there's so that's the critical sort of factor. I talked earlier about the importance of home ownership at some level. And so what we see is that for people of color, it actually extends their time to home ownership. And we know that home ownership in a free market private property economy is the primary way in which wealth is generated in an economy like ours. But for people of color who go to college, whether they finish or not, again, it often delays home ownership, which means by delaying home ownership, it means that you're building less equity, you're building less wealth. And this goes back to the cost of college. And I'll say this too, this sort of final point, that this issue in particular about the financial cost for folks of color, particularly African Americans, was not something that wasn't considered by the Reagan administration. And in fact, when I give lectures, I often show a memo that comes from a prominent Reagan official telling the administration that if you cut Pell Grants, that Pell Grants was a primary means for Black upper mobility. So the administration understood what was going on, and they shrugged their shoulders. So Reagan shrugged. He really effectively didn't care the cost this would have on this particular population. But I'll sort of say this too, what they missed and didn't calculate, the blind spot of the administration, was the ways in which these financial products, i.e. funded student loans, would not simply sort of spread within the Black community, but also would escape their quarantine in those Black spaces and actually enter into broader white spaces. And now, as I said before, the vast majority of students who go to college have to borrow. That part was not imagined by the Reagan administration. Yes, it's going to target, have a different impact on folks of color. What they fundamentally missed and didn't realize was the cost it would have on the quote unquote average middle class family today. And this is what Biden in many ways is right. trying to address in his efforts to sort of pull some of the cost out of of higher education.
You make such an important point. Conservatives have often targeted any government aid program that they have felt disproportionately serves people of color, particularly African Americans, and programs that serve primarily white Americans. They don't necessarily overtly go after, although that's debatable too. But if it's seen as benefiting disproportionately people of color or immigrants, it is up for grabs and often faces cuts. So let's talk about Biden's plan, the fact that it is limited to $10,000 of debt forgiveness, which doesn't come close to the average $30,000 owed by Americans. The fact that there is, so there's a little nod to Pell Grant recipients who get $20,000 written off. But other than that, is there any attempt to address the racial wealth gap and how the student debt problem disproportionately affects students of color?
It's a modest attempt, it's a modest attempt, particularly like you mentioned before with the Pell Grant aspect of it too, and also the what's called the IDR, the income driven repayment sort of plan, which will half the percentage that one has to pay. So that's an attempt at it, but it still is just a drop in the bucket. And until you fundamentally address, and this is what I sort of said at the beginning, about the conception and view of students not as tax eaters, but not as, and here I'm using the language from the Reagan administration, quote, leeches or backs of taxpayers. This is actually how they talk about college students, how they thought about them. Leeches on the backs of taxpayers.
Wow.
Until you reimagine this and view the college student as a future tax contributor. And so that's the reason to properly and fully fund higher education. Until you change that mindset, you'll always be chasing the tail of the cost of college. Until you change that fundamental mindset.
And of course, that mindset is never, that view or lens is never applied to tax cuts for the rich or corporate subsidies. Exactly. But suddenly, when it comes to forgiving the debt of individuals who went to college, you have all of these claims about how this is a giveaway, a handout, et cetera, et cetera. I want to talk about the means-tested part of this whole equation, the plan that cuts off for those earning $125,000. Those who earn more than $125,000 won't have their debt forgiven. And it just seems that this becomes this point of contention that we only forgive the debt of those that we claim are deserving of it. Some have said that this is a trickle-up economics. It was, I believe, someone in the Washington Post, Catherine Rampell, supposedly liberal economist who made this bizarre claim. One article in the New York Times just this past week about the debate around this said, some critics say the plan is still a giveaway to the rich, or more precisely, people who stand to be rich sometime soon, like young doctors and lawyers who are just starting out in their fields. I mean, it just blows my mind that this country needs, especially doctors. Why would we want young doctors to start their careers tens of thousands of dollars in debt, because maybe someday they might earn more than $125,000 a year?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I often think about that famous line that we've heard when we go to college, first year of college or law school. You go into the classroom, and the professor in front of the class say to you, look to your left, look to your right. I'm sure they don't say these things nowadays, but when I first went to college many, many years ago, look to your left, look to your right. One of you won't be here. And the argument, and what underlies that construction is this notion that we're at this level peers, and we're competing, we're peers in this space. And so I bring that up because the giveaway in many ways is for the student who didn't have to borrow to go to college. That all students who go to college in a classroom whether you borrow or not, benefit from sitting next to one another and being one another. And that once you enter the hallowed halls into in my classroom space, that you all are peers and competing equally. But the way in which financial aid construction is set up today is that it excludes those students who didn't have to borrow, when they really in many ways should be the ones who also pay for the cost of those who are receiving financial aid. And I know some systems outside the US have what's called a graduation tax. And for me, that's it may not be the ideal system, but it's a much fairer one, Sonali. And a graduation tax would basically be this, that if you graduate from college, whether you took out a student loan or not, if you graduate from college, you pay a percentage of your income, if you make over a certain amount of money, back to the next generation. It's almost the definition of paying it forward. And for
to,
me,
to
that's
subsidize
fair,
the education of
so, yes, to me, that's a fair system, because individuals who don't borrow from college benefit materially tremendously from sitting next to the classroom from those who actually have to borrow. And I say this as a professor. Right. My classrooms are much more fulfilling, robust, and dynamic, those discussions and conversations, when you have students from a range of backgrounds. And so we all benefit, whether you borrow or not, from attending college.
Finally,
yes.
Just to close out our conversation, erasing $10,000 or $20,000 of student debt is a tiny little temporary band-aid, is it not? I know that President Biden has made some gestures toward making it easier to repay or repaying slower. There was, of course, during the lockdowns, there was a moratorium on paying back loans. But none of that addresses the broader issue of the fact that higher education has been defunded. And so how do we make it accessible so that students don't have to take out loans in the first place? There are people who are paying off their loans past retirement, and they've paid them off many times over because of compounded interest. They're just paying, you know, multiple times the original that they borrowed, and they're still not done. So how do we address it in the long term? Shouldn't we go back to an era when when the cost of higher education was simply so cheap or free that anybody could go?
See, and this is the my plug for maybe another segment, because the answer to that question is a more equitable tax system. And that's the answer to that question, really, in many ways. A more equitable tax system where you really are properly and duly taxing corporations, the uber wealthy, uber rich, then you'll be able to have a real system of financial higher education in which you're not really penalizing those who have achieved academically but want to go to college. And so a fair and more equitable sort of tax system is really the main answer to that question of how do you have a higher education system where you're not really punishing and financially penalizing on those who have the ability to go to college and the skills, but not the financial resources.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Devin Fergus. We'll post a link to your Washington Post op-ed from our website. Best of luck to you.
Thanks so much, Salam. Take care.
My guest has been Devin Fergus, a Distinguished Professor of History and Black Studies at the University of Missouri. His books include Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs, and the Decline of the American Middle Class. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.